Hey there, you're listening to Ghost Notes and Friends, the podcast where we talk about music inside and out with friends. My name is Noah, but you probably know me better as Polyphonic.
And I'm Corey, and you probably know me as 12 Tone. And today I'm super excited about this guest. I cannot believe he agreed to talk to us. But joining us today, we have the author of an upcoming book about music history that will change maybe everything, just revolutionize the world and make everything a utopia.
Definitely solve hunger.
Yeah, solve hunger.
At the very least.
Not necessarily world hunger, but just like the concept of hunger. No one will ever...
Someone will eat this book.
Feel hunger. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, now that we've fully introduced this amazing author, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi there. My name is Noah Lefebvre, and I am the author of Century of Song, 101 Songs That Shaped American History. Which is a book coming out this fall wherever books are sold.
Yeah, like stores probably.
Stores, online stores.
Yeah, offline stores. Those are the
brick and mortar stores. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is a project that has been in the works for me for well over a year now. With all of the getting stuff written and doing all the process and stuff. And now we officially have sort of a launch date. I can officially go public about this. So we thought that it would be fun to, in place of having a guest this week, have me on as a guest and just talk about this book a little and the premise and the process of making it and all of that stuff.
Like I said, before we started recording, I want to hear about this book. I want to know what's in it, how you put it together. Like, I think it's a really, really interesting approach to this sort of thing. And also, like, I know you well enough to know that it's going to be a really good book. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, do you want to start sort of like walk through what it is sort of at a conceptual level?
Yeah. So essentially what it is it's a history of American popular music as told through 101 different songs. So I've picked a song to represent every year from 1923 to 2023. And the idea is that each of these songs is sort of a song that captures the social, aesthetic, historical zeitgeist of whatever was happening in that year. So often it's a reflection of broader cultural things happening, historical events, but then it's also, sort of honing in on like aesthetic movements that were happening and genres being born and what was happening. So it sort of touches, as most of my stuff does, both on musical history and how musical history ties into the broader history of America.
Yeah, and the cultural histories that it's connected to.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I guess I'm going to start with, I think, probably the question most Ghost Notes listeners are wondering, which is, of those 101 songs, how many are by Bob Dylan?
Well, funny you should ask. I actually, one of the rules that I sort of gave myself as I was working on this, because I wanted to be able to have as many different artists as I could in here. So I only allowed myself one song per artist. So with that being said, there are two songs written by Bob Dylan on this, because there is Like a Rolling Stone, and there is also Jimi Hendrix's cover of All Along the Watchtower.
That makes a lot of sense.
And a couple more in honorable mentions. That was sort of part of the puzzle of it. It was challenging, but it was very fun sort of figuring out, okay, I was pretty sure from the beginning, 1965, Like a Rolling Stone, that was one of the ones that I was sure on from the beginning. I was sure on 1965, Like a Rolling Stone. I was sure on 1991, which you can probably guess.
Yeah. Everything I do it for you.
Yes, exactly. It was Smells Like Teen Spirit. That's 91. But there was a couple things that were locked in, but then there were artists that I needed to play around with, move around, sort of see, Jimi Hendrix is in 1968, then where do we find time to slot in the Velvet Underground or Beach Boys or, things like that? It was a lot of puzzling and slotting. And the whole idea is not that these are the single only definitive important song of that year. It's not even that they're the best or most important song of that year, but it's more sort of tracing the history of American popular music through these songs. And each of those songs reflects something happening in that year, one way or another.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think it's really interesting as an optimization problem. Because yes, you have this, you want to get like the most important song of that year and the most important song by important artists. And like you say, sometimes those come out in the same year. And so trying to balance all of like those two variables is like, I love optimization problems.
Yeah.
Like, this is a thing that people who have listened to this podcast for the, God, 3 years now we've been doing it. Is that right? That can't be right.
We're ancient.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, people who've been listening to this podcast for a long time or just watched one or more of my videos probably know that about me. But like, I just, it's really interesting as a puzzle because, like, again, you could very easily go in and just list, like, you know, as someone who's very familiar with Bob Dylan's catalog, I'm sure you could come up with Bob Dylan songs that are arguably the most important song in quite a few years.
Yeah.
And so picking which one of those is most important and which ones don't eclipse other people's most important songs, I think it's a really cool problem.
There's some years that are real sort of like bottlenecks, you know, like you've got your like,
I mean, 1991.
Yeah. Yeah. 1971 is a famously sort of stacked year. 77, 67, 68. Mm-hmm. I racked my brain and had a lot of fun with some of these. I also didn't have a lot of fun where, you know, there were songs that I really wanted to write about that I had to cut and couldn't. But it's exactly what you said. It's an optimization problem. And it's how can you tell the best sort of story of a century of American history? And I think I came up with a good list by these sort of paradigms. I'm pretty happy with the success of this.
And there's, I think, a third variable to consider that I'm sure you considered, which is style, right? Because like, you know, if 1991 is Smells Like Teen Spirit.
I did consider style. Style is actually my song for 2014.
Yes, exactly. if 1991 is Smells Like Teen Spirit, there's so many good grunge songs you could pick for 1992 and 1993 and 1994. Like it's just a question of like, but of course other things were happening too, right? Like that's also a huge era for hip hop.
Yeah.
And so trying to balance, like, I'm curious how you approached making sure that you were telling, because like you and I have talked before about, you know, lists, how these lists, like, especially in rock, will be like the 100 greatest songs.
Yeah.
And it's implicitly the 100 greatest rock songs. And I know how you feel about that. So I'm sure you tried your best to avoid that. I'm curious sort of that process as well.
Yeah, that was a big part of it is I wanted to get a lot of genres. The nature of stuff is that there are some genres that I just could not get in. I got very little electronic music in, except in honorable mentions. It's not really my forte. Doesn't mean it's not important. Just means I didn't feel qualified to write on some of this. And yeah, like I think it's interesting because, you know, in that sense, yeah, I guess each of the different eras had different challenges, but in that sense, like one of the easier aspects of doing the stuff in like the 20s and 30s was like, there were like two genres of music, you know, like there was like blues and pop and like country was just blues and like, you know, jazz was just blues or and I guess folk. So then like it's really sort of in the 60s when things really started to sort of spread. And then especially I had such a tough time with the 80s because in the 80s you have sort of American metal reaching its zenith. You have pop music reaching its zenith. You have American hip hop like really breaking onto the scene. You have a huge era for punk. So there was definitely a lot of like, I mean, one of the things by virtue of having to try to squeeze as much as I could in, like the first metal song I actually have in there is Seek and Destroy, which is 1983, which that's a bit of an odd chapter. Cause it's like, hey, metal had been around for like a decade and a half. That was just a thing that happened. But one of the interesting things with that too, though, is
kind of forgot to mention Paranoid, but you know, I say forgot, that was 1971. right?
Yeah.
Or was that 70?
I think 71. But yeah,
that's... I think Paranoid was 71.
The other aspect to that, too, is just that... So originally, I meant to do just like 100 songs, but those... It became immediately clear that those parameters were way too wide. So I narrowed in on American music because as I was making this, I sort of realized ultimately that's kind of what I am, is I'm a scholar of American popular music. I'm a traitor to my Canadian...
Oh, so yeah. Are there no Canadian artists? Assuming...
Alanis Morissette is in there.
Okay.
There's one... I allowed myself one British artist, which was the Beatles, because they're the Beatles.
Okay, yeah. I was assuming American in a broader sense, but that makes sense.
So that was sort of... The original vibe was American in a broader sense, in the way that, like, you know, spaghetti is Italian food, rock and roll is American music, hip hop is American music. But it was like too sort of overwhelming. So I really narrowed down into the American thing. And that was really interesting because it was something that I don't think I really realized on the metal thing until I was in it. Like, there was American metal, but like thrash was really like America's first sort of like uniquely American metal that really sort of like took off and slots into the American history that I'm telling as well, which was interesting.
Wasn't Death an American band?
Yeah, I think they were. Yeah.
Okay. I thought so.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, they are the first like three major waves of metal are British.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
That's historically like it did not move to America. Like, it, you know, there were American metal bands at the time, but like the big ones, the big scenes, like you have, you know, your Black Sabbath era, and then you have the new wave of British heavy metal.
Yeah.
And then like, yeah, it's really not until the 80s that you start to see a lot of American metal.
One of the things you sort of have in this is you kind of have moments like that where, you know, talking about Kill 'Em All suddenly also needs to be sort of a whole chapter about metal and where metal came from and how it came from, while simultaneously focusing and talking about Kill 'Em All. So that was one of the more interesting challenges of it.
Yeah, I mean, it does, if you are focusing on America specifically, that does feel like it lightens a lot of the load through the 70s.
Yes.
Like, yeah. I'm sure it wasn't easy still, but there's so many of those, like, you know, again, Sabbath or like Led Zeppelin or...
Yeah. No Pink Floyd, no Zeppelin, none of those, which really narrowed stuff down. And especially, honestly, focusing on 70s, I do have some like rock in the 70s. Like I've got Born to Run, like Bruce Springsteen, but really like America in the 70s is...
Oh, Bruce Springsteen's American?
No, he's from New Jersey, actually, not America.
we'll let that one slide.
Apologies to any of our New Jersey listeners.
On behalf of the New England delegation, I do not apologize.
It's interesting because, yeah, you think so much of that 70s sort of arena rock thing, but so many of those bands are British, and the biggest thing actually happening in America in the 70s was disco. So we've got sort of three or two and a half to three different sort of like disco songs in the 70s, because that was the cultural moment in the 70s, kind of famously.
Yes. No, there is a pretty well-known history there.
Yeah.
That someone, I think, has a pretty good video about.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And I mean, I think
I wasn't talking about you.
No. Okay. But I think that's another interesting thing that, you know, like one of the big things for me too, in addition to trying to get sort of diversity of genre, I was trying to get as many sort of queer artists, women, people of color was not really difficult because American music is the history of American music is mostly the history of people of color.
I mean, if your history has jazz, hip hop, and soul,
exactly.
It's a little hard to not tell those stories, but and rock, like, to be clear,
yes,
like it's a complicated history there, but like really, you know, you can't tell a story of, especially early rock, without Chuck Berry. I assume he's on there.
Chuck Berry is actually an honorable mention.
Okay,
who we do have for the early history of rock is Little Richard.
All right, that's also very fair.
Yeah, some of my tastes also need to like inevitably sort of shone through. So 1958, the year that Chuck Berry released Johnny B. Goode, is the year that Miles Davis released Milestones, which is sort of the birth of modal jazz. And it was also sort of the year that I needed to get my Miles Davis in there. So Chuck Berry got bumped, which is like, honestly, that was one of the ones that was really tough for me, but it is what it is. And like,
And it's especially like with like early rock and roll, like that history really spans like 5 years. I like would naturally, like I said, gravitate to like Chuck Berry as the one I would go with. But like, you know, putting in Chuck Berry basically means you can't put in Little Richard.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can't put in like Fats Domino, and you can't like, there's so like, because it's all so condensed historic.
Or it means you can't put in this guy named Elvis Presley, who turns out was pretty important.
Yeah. I mean, if I had to choose between including Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley, but, you know, again, that depends on what happened in what year, too. And again, there's so many optimization problems.
That's sort of something that's really important for me to sort of stress about this. And I stress it in the like foreword of the book. And like, this is an exercise in like it's a thought experiment more than a definitive history, right? Like there's no possible way with those parameters that you could tell the entire story of American history. It's just of American musical history. It's just too rich. There's
Or even like the top highlights. Like I think you have enough constraints on you. And I think it's, and this is the thing, like this is, I think, good. I think it's good to put enough constraints that it's clear that what you're saying is not these are the 100 most important songs.
Yeah.
It's these are 100 important songs.
Yeah.
Like, I think that that's like, I mean, not to throw like a wild analogy, but like when I did my video recently where I just ran a bunch of scales through a single elimination tournament because I was bored and I thought it would be fun. But like, it was really important to me to structure that in a way that really could not be read as me saying that whichever one wound up winning was the best scale. It just had to be like, look, this is so obviously like constrained in so many ways that you can't answer this question. And I think similarly here, putting that like one per year thing releases you from the implication that these could possibly be the 100 most important songs.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, if you're also communicating, you know, doing like the one per artist thing and limiting yourself specifically to America, like there's just, it winds up making it much more clear that this is a story, not the story.
Yeah. And I think that's a great way of putting it. Yeah. It is a version of a story that, you know, has been told and will be told 1,000 different ways by 1,000 different people. I think it's interesting because, like, as any history is, like, my history is also, it's a reflection of our current ongoing narrative of American history. And that narrative will change and is actively changing because history has this thing where it doesn't stop, you know?
It keeps going.
Yeah, it's quite annoying. I'd like it to stop for at least a week so we can just chill, you know?
If we could just, especially living in America, we've had too much history recently.
Yes, there's been,
We've also had some very good history recently. Like, I don't want to imply that, like, but like we have had some bad history recently.
There's been a lot of history recently. Yeah, well, and one of the things that I sort of noticed, again, this is just sort of a stray observation that I found really interesting, is in the, so one of the things that I wanted to focus on was making sure that sort of women's impact on music history was present in my book and known, because women are often written out of music history. And it's really interesting because I sort of had this impression where I was like, you know, from the more modern age, sort of from the 80s on, it's going to be easy. Like, there's a lot of huge pop stars who are women. And I was right about that. But what I sort of was completely wrong about was I was like, it's going to be really tough finding a lot of women like way back at the turn of the century. And it's interesting because it's like, no, actually, like, there's way more impact of women at the birth of blues and jazz. And then really it's like in the 40s and then especially through like the 50s, 60s, 70s, yeah, when women really get edged out of American popular music, which I thought was quite interesting because, like at the birth of the blues, the first blues stars in America, which were some of the first American, like, music stars, were like Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith and Ethel Waters, like, it, which is, it just sort of goes to show, you know, sometimes I think sometimes we have these ideas of, like, linear progression of history, and it's not always the case.
Yeah. And, like, I've definitely found through my work, like, I run into this problem that I'm sure you've run into as well with, like, video stuff, where, you know, I want to make more videos about women, especially in rock, because that's what I mostly make videos about. And it's what I mostly consider myself an expert on. And so, like, I keep trying. And what I find is that, like, there are so many incredible, like, well-known women in rock, but none of them basically are at that, like, highest tier.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's this sudden drop off of, like...
To be clear, highest tier of, like, popularity, not of quality. Yeah. Yeah.
Not of quality, not even necessarily of impact.
Yeah.
But, like, in terms of, like, who the names are, and the names are, like, Led Zeppelin, they're Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
They're then, like... You get, Fleetwood Mac is, like, kind of an honorary entry into that, but even they feel, like, a little bit less big.
Yeah.
And I've multiple times put, like, A Piece of My Heart by Janis Joplin on a Patreon poll to see if people would like, and that, like, that feels like such a classic to me.
Yeah.
And I've seen no interest. And obviously, like, especially with video work, there's, like, there can be, like, an order of magnitude difference in video performance between a song that everyone knows and a song that most people know.
Yeah.
Like, it's ridiculous. And so, like, there's this, all of that push away from that. And, like, you sort of, I think that's another thing that, like, when you're trying to find, like, who is the most important, a lot of that will sort of push you naturally away from that. So I think, I'm glad you're correcting for it. I think it's important to correct for it because there are, again, like you say, it's not hard to find important and impactful women in basically any genre of music at basically any era. But, like, trying to find, like, who the biggest names are gets tricky.
I think sort of speaking to that, like, one of the things that I, like, that was a genuine sort of pleasure of doing this was just the joy of not working within algorithmic constraints. Like, like, that was... Yeah. That was such a pleasure to be able to be like, no, I can, you know, I can actually, like, write in depth about Florence Reese and Which Side Are You On, or Ethel Waters, or, you know, these Patsy Cline, these people that are, like incredibly important. And like, it's not even a hot take that Patsy Cline is important, right? Like, nobody would argue that. It's just, if I did a Patsy Cline video on my channel,
no one clicks it.
Yeah, it would absolutely tank, no question. And so it was really refreshing. Yeah.
Yeah, I had that with, like, Jolene by Dolly Parton, which is Jolene by Dolly Parton, and that video still bombed.
Yeah, one of the greatest, most celebrated songs in music history. It was quite enjoyable to be able to just sort of write and say the things that I wanted to say. And also, I mean, things I've never particularly paid too much attention to this stuff, but, you know, like, being able to talk about things like war and conflict and sex and drugs and like things that, you know, happen in the world that YouTube advertisers don't like to imagine happen in the world, or don't want to acknowledge happen in the world.
No, not something that M&M's wants to be seen as endorsing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because, like, you know, so much of that YouTube work is so caught up in packaging and so caught up in, like, selling this thing as a great, and the thing with a book is, like, what you're selling is 100 songs handpicked by Polyphonic.
Yeah.
And so you have a lot more of that freedom. And I don't have a question now because you already answered it. But that was, I think, a really interesting aspect of it as well. And, you know, one of the things that makes this feel like a cool project in it, as opposed to just, you know, like 100 polyphonic scripts.
I think this is the thing, is I think there are things that, you know, just by the nature of this and my channel, like there are definitely a number of things that I have done videos on that are in here that are sort of adapted, and a lot of sort of themes that I've touched on. But at the same time, yeah, it's, I'm very happy with it because it feels like something that is me, but is not necessarily polyphonic. Like I was able to do stuff that I couldn't do on the channel, and able to even just experiment with sort of narrative and form in a way that is sort of discouraged by the nature of YouTube's algorithmically driven content. And that was super rewarding.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. Like I said, I'm very much looking forward to reading it. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about with it?
Because this is a polyphonic thing, because it is done by me, I also have done visuals for it. So each chapter has its own unique piece of artwork. And the cover was made by me, which is cool because I've always wanted to design a book cover.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's just like a fun little treat that I got to do. But yeah, one of the big things is as I always tried to do, I created accompanying visuals that are also meant to sort of tell the stories of this, you know, just of this history in its own visual aesthetic way. So there's a lot of that in there too. Yeah, I think one of the interesting things too to sort of talk about is, I think we've talked a lot about like doing stuff in the 60s and the 40s and the 30s and the 80s.
Yeah.
One of the really interesting challenges was doing the stuff in the 2020s, you know, like sort of, it's so difficult. And, you know, maybe these things will age very poorly. I'm sure there are things that will, but it's so difficult to sort of, when you're living through history, to note what aspects of it get made in history and how that story gets told and stuff like that. So there's, you know, there's some things that it also, just writing this, it's interesting because there's stuff that feels so fresh and I now realize is like, you know, half a decade ago, like, you know, Billie Eilish hitting the scene was sort of a huge moment. That was half a decade ago. Like
that was 2017. Yeah. I'm literally working on a Billie Eilish video right now that actually will not be out by the time this episode comes out on Nebula. So if you're listening to this on Nebula, there's the spoiler. I'm doing a video about Bad Guy.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, I was going to ask what you picked for 2017, because that seems like a fairly obvious one, but I'm sure there were other competitors.
Yes. 2017 is Despacito.
Oh, that makes sense.
It's an interesting thing with 2017. Like,
was Despacito 2017?
Yep.
Well, okay, I believe you. That feels like it was longer ago, but also feels like it was more recent.
Oh, wait, maybe Despacito. So Despacito, it is both 2017 and more recent. So it's kind of a complicated thing where it was originally released in 2017. And then the remix also was released in 2017. Okay. But yeah, there are also a couple things where I needed to sort of fudge dates a little. I mean, I told the dates honestly, like I didn't make up, but sometimes, you know, a song that was important in 1974 was actually released in December 1973 or something like that, right? Yeah.
Or like, you know, the single came out before the album and that was across a year boundary or something.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think the biggest sort of stretch one is I had Before He Cheats by Carrie Underwood, which is one of these songs that sort of was released and then was like a really like a sleeper hit.
Yeah.
It really took a long time. And then when it blew up, it really blew up. So I kind of allowed myself a little leeway from that, also to get more modern country in there, because I didn't have a lot of room for modern country.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny because some of the things, it's sort of like the more recent stuff, I think it trends towards a lot of the sort of more popular songs, which you know, I don't think that's entirely wrong. I also don't think that's entirely right. Yeah. I think it's
harder to tell, like, with underground stuff. Like, it's easy to look back and say, like, yeah, the Velvet Underground was a huge deal.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, back into the, like, the Melvins were a huge deal in retrospect.
Yeah.
But, like, if you were writing that list in the late 80s, it would never have occurred to you to consider the Melvins.
Yeah.
Like,
but then I think there's also these moments where, like, one that it was up there with, up there for me with, like, Smells Like Teen Spirit and Like a Rolling Stone, where when I came up with the concept, I immediately knew this one was my song for 2020, which is Walking in the Snow by Run the Jewels. I remember just like that song coming out and feeling like a historic moment when, you know, a week after George Floyd, Run the Jewels drop a song where like one of Killer Mike's whole verses is like ends on, you know, the I can't breathe words. And like, it's interesting because that one was just such an electric sort of cultural moment. And I think that was
very hard to argue.
It's interesting to see. Yeah. It's interesting to see which moments in my life I now sort of, I feel like I could have told you the day that was released that I would think that was the most important song of the year for a long time. Right.
Yeah. I mean, that ties, not specifically the Run the Jewels thing, but the overall discussion there ties into, I think, an important question, an important consideration with any sort of project like this, which, you know, and this is true of, like, your video work and my video work as well, is sort of canonization and contributing to that and shaping that and being sort of a part of that. Because you talk about, you know, you write these things, will these songs actually stay, remain relevant in like 20 years? It's easy to look back and say, like, in 20 years, Stairway to Heaven, probably still recognizable as a historically important song.
Yeah.
But like, it's much harder to say that about anything that was released in 2023, no matter how momentous it feels now. And that makes it hard to judge, but also like makes you part of that conversation, right? Like part of that development.
Yeah.
Like you can't go back in time. You can't really do much to knock Stairway to Heaven off its pedestal. But like, there's other songs from the 70s that could theoretically be elevated in ways that, you know, get them canonized as well. But especially for more recent stuff, deciding what we talk about now affects what we talk about in the future.
Well, and I think it's interesting because I think like that's something you and I have talked about a lot, is sort of being conscientious of our roles as contributors to a cultural canon. And I think it's interesting because I think, I don't know if this is justified or not, but I feel like I felt that weight more writing a book than doing a video. And I don't actually think there's functionally, like functionally more people will watch one of my videos than will read this book. But there's something about it being in print where, you know, videos always feel a little intangible.
Yeah.
Right?
Like intangible and also like lower prestige.
Yes.
Right.
And lower stakes too. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Probably because of the lower prestige.
And it is a larger project, right? Like no one polyphonic video can be viewed as a representation of Noah's entire view of what the canon should be, because there are hundreds of them. But so far, there's only one book you've written. I say so far, I don't know what your plans are, but
I might write more in the future. So I'm definitely going to write more books. I might write more nonfiction books. I've also got fiction books I'm working on.
Oh, nice.
When those are published, we'll do podcasts about those. I agree. Like there is, and especially as sort of my first published book, it's making some sort of a statement, and hopefully like I put a lot of thought into making sure that I made it right and approached this with thought and care. And I think it comes through in the final text. If it doesn't, you can podcast divorce me when
I will,
when it comes out.
I've already drafted up the paperwork.
Who gets Caleb?
I think Caleb gets to decide.
Yeah, that's fair. It's a neat project. And it's funny, as I've been telling like family and friends about it. Yeah. One thing, everyone's first reaction, which I find very interesting, is just to ask what the song for their birth year is.
Yeah.
Which I think it's funny. I think it makes sense because, you know, that's a personal connection. But really, I'm like, what you should be asking is, what's the song for when I was 14?
Yeah.
You know, like, because your birth year. Yeah. I mean, I can't speak for everyone, but I was not very tapped into music when I was a newborn.
Yeah. All right. Well, in that case, I'll ask 2004.
2004. Oh, 2004 is easy. That is American Idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll like, and
I buy it.
2005. 2005. This one will also resonate well with you. BYOB.
Sure. Sure. Yep.
You'll be happy that I got some new metal on there.
Yep. Yeah, no, I mean, I assume that 1998 was Dracula, but was that 98 or was that 97? I think that was 98.
Very similar song to Dracula, but not Dracula. 98 was Baby One More Time by Britney Spears.
Yeah.
I always say that's the Dracula of her catalog.
The duality of man. But yeah, no. Did not even occur to me to ask my birth year.
Well, then you're special.
Yeah.
You're different than everyone else.
Yeah.
Feel good.
No, I was just thinking back to years that I recognized as historically important, and 1989 is not one of those, but
yeah,
it's close to one.
Tell that to Taylor Swift.
I mean, look, I appreciate that she named an album after the year I was born. It's very kind of you, Taylor, but it's just... Not that no important stuff in music happened in 1989, obviously, but it's just in my mind so eclipsed by what happened in 1991. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting in my mind, 1989, and I sort of write about this. My song for 1989 is Public Enemies Fight the Power. And in my mind, I think that sort of, you know, these things are kind of nebulous, but yeah, that is as good a candidate as any for the, like, you know, kicking off of the hip hop golden age.
Yeah.
Like I think 1989, you know, you could also argue 1988, like late 80s. You could argue a bit later if you wanted, but like, I think for me, Fight the Power is sort of the song that we are officially in the golden age of hip hop when that song comes out. So that's 1989.
Makes sense.
I think that's one of the interesting things also, though, is like, it makes you appreciate how there are no unimportant years.
Yeah.
There are definitely years that are bigger and more happens. But like, going through this every year, I'm like, oh, that's a huge thing that happened. That's a huge thing that happened. Like, turns out a year's a long time, and a lot of good and important music gets released in that time.
This is, I think, a thing that is easy to lose track of when you've had a couple decades worth of them. But yeah, years are not short.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Cultural time span, a year is, like, even on a personal time span, a year is a long time. Like, I am very in a very different position than I was 1 year ago today. Not literally. Yeah. I was probably in the same room 1 year ago today.
I am literally in a very different position.
That's true.
I am across the continent from where I was 1 year ago today.
Oh, very true. But yeah, but no, that's, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's, I mean, like, I get it being surprising intuitively, but it's also like trying to imagine the other possibility where somehow we went an entire year with no one doing anything interesting in music.
Yeah.
That seems way less likely to me. Like, how would you even do that? Maybe if you had a general, like, musician strike, but then there'd still be like strike and protest music to talk about.
Well, so fun fact, there was a general musician strike that I actually talk about a lot in this. What happens during the general musician strike is vocal groups take off, and one Frank Sinatra sees his career boom. And, you know, that's pretty important. So damn vocalists.
I don't think Frank Sinatra had like that much of an impact on music. If I remember correctly.
Damn vocalists crossing picket lines.
Well, it was complicated. Like, as a vocalist, I feel the need to defend that, like, actually...
Yeah, defend your people.
It was a different union. It's complicated. And, you know...
All I know is the bassist showed solidarity.
The bassists were in the musicians' union.
And exactly, and they didn't leave it.
Yeah.
That's solidarity.
That is one definition of solidarity. Although I will say, the basses as a vocal class, they didn't, so...
One of the actual interesting stories to come out of that, too, I mean, there's literally books written on it. But one of the interesting things to come out of it is that, and I sort of kind of knew this, but I really got into the details of it writing my chapter for 1946, which is Charlie Parker and bebop. One of the interesting things is that bebop was actually invented a couple years before, but then it wasn't recorded because of the musician strike. So they were just sort of playing it in the underground. And it was this sort of secret movement that was able to, you know, happen for people in the know. And then once the strike was over, it broke. So bebop had actually been stewing for far longer than, you know, just sort of the recorded record would show. And I think there's a lot of stories like that in this where, you know, using the date of a record's release is a useful metric, but it really does not tell the whole story.
It kind of never does, but that's, you know, you do sort of have to nail something down, but I think that sort of speaks to some of the validity of what you were saying earlier about, like, occasionally just like fudging numbers a little bit to get it to a point where, like, you know, because it's not necessarily true that a song that comes out on December 29th of a year is going to be more important to that year than the next one. Like, that's, I mean, even you look at, like, 1991, like, Smells Like Teen Spirit came out pretty late. Nevermind came out pretty late in that year. And mostly its cultural impact was in 1992.
I think it's interesting, too. There's things like, so I have Elvis Presley before Little Richard on this, which is odd because if you look at that, you'd expect Little Richard to come first. But the reality is, like, Little Richard was doing his thing, just record companies weren't buying that music. They didn't think it could sell to white audiences. Then Elvis did it, and suddenly they realized there was a market for white audiences, and suddenly Little Richard's music really popped, even though the music was... just as quality the whole time. There's a bit of treachery to dates that can be sort of dangerous in this pursuit. That was one of the interesting traps.
And that, I think, ties back to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier as well, with the point of this sort of thing is very much to play a game, right? Like, it's not to say, like, this is the definitive, serious, and best and most accurate, like, way to do this, because the best and most accurate way to do this doesn't place a bunch of artificial constraints on itself.
Yeah.
But, you know, once you place those, then you have to, like, solve the problems that they create, and, like, you get to have, like, fun with that, and you get answers that are a set of answers rather than making any sort of definitive claim about being objectively the most clear and important history that you could possibly tell.
Yeah, that's very well said.
It's also just sort of, and I say this as a positive, even though it might not sound like it, but it's also sort of a very YouTuber way to think about this sort of thing, you know? Like, it's the sort of thing that you and I learned to do by making these sorts of videos is, like, constructing a premise rather than going at it from, like, a pure historian perspective, just being like, what is the angle, what is the story, and how does it flow, and putting these constraints, I think it's a really interesting set of constraints, and I'm, like, again, I keep saying this, very excited to read the book.
You know, we've talked about this lots in sort of many contexts. One of the joys of creating is putting those constraints upon yourself and seeing how they help you tell something that winds up being maybe more interesting or more cohesive, or maybe not more cohesive, in fact, often less cohesive, yeah, but more interesting for that.
Yeah.
And it was really fun. Yeah. And yeah, I think I'm glad that you're excited. And I think anyone who likes this podcast will like it. I think anyone who likes my channel will probably like it. Yeah. I guess that's my thought.
And anyone who doesn't like this podcast, hi.
Good to see you're still here, yeah, after 60 episodes.
Thanks for
appreciate that.
And also the last hour of your life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe they just like my book and wanted to hear about it.
Exactly. Well, I'm sorry you had to deal with me.
The book to podcast pipeline.
Yeah. Classic. But yeah, I'm out of questions. Do we want to just like transition to telling people how they can get this?
We've rambled on plenty about this. Yeah. So the book is called Century of Song, 101 Songs That Shaped American Music. It can be found Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Blackwell's, if you're in the UK, Chapters Indigo, if you're in Canada, generally where books are bought. You can pre-order it now. Pre-ordering it would be really lovely. Pre-ordering helps me a ton. One of the fun little, I don't know if I'm legally allowed to say this, but one of the fun little secrets, I'm pretty sure I'm legally allowed to say it, it's public knowledge. But one of the fun little secrets about sort of like bestseller lists and stuff like that,
yeah,
is that the first week that it's for sale, all of the pre-orders count as being sold in that first week. So it can really sort of like boost books on the chart and really help them get some visibility. So if you want to pre-order it, I would love that.
Yeah. By the way, I'm pretty sure you are allowed to say that because I already knew that.
Yes. Well, like I said, it's public knowledge. I just don't want the shady book cabal coming after me.
Yeah. But yeah, there'll be links to pre-order in the show description if Noah sends them to me.
Yeah. 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 There's links to pre-order. And if you want to wait to get it physically, that's fine too. Yeah. It comes out September 17th.
Cool.
So it's still a bit of a ways out, but it comes out September 17th in time for Christmas. I don't know. You know all the promo stuff that I should be saying here.
Yeah, just get the book. Just you listen to us talk about it for an hour. Get the book.
Yeah, just buy my book.
Yeah, just buy the book.
Just buy my book.
One other thing I meant to mention this real quick at the beginning and completely forgot. But just to clarify, you probably figured this out by now, but since if you're listening to this on Nebula, the episode does drop on April 1st. This is a real thing.
This is not.
This is happening. Yes. Noah did write this book. He's been telling me about it for months, unless it's a very elaborate prank that he had me write a blurb for. This is a real announcement.
That's funny. I didn't realize. It's funny. I actually decided I'm putting together an April Fool's video, and I'm probably going to be announcing the book then too.
Oh no. So. Just to clarify, if you think that this is the most elaborate and dry prank we have ever pulled on you, I mean, if that's what we were doing, this probably wouldn't dissuade you, but that's not what's happening.
It would be hilarious if we did that, but no,
I don't even know what the point of this joke, what is the punchline? Like, what is this joke building toward?
We make you click on a link and get disappointed.
Yeah, it's a Rickroll. We're just so in touch with what the kids these days are doing.
Yeah. I love the idea that it's all an elaborate Rickroll. hey, maybe it is. You'll need to find out now.
Yeah. But do click the pre-order link.
Yes.
Either please. You can get Noah's book or you can hear a cool song by Rick Astley. Either way, you win.
Yeah. Yeah. Please check that out. Spread the word. And yeah, I'm really excited for you guys to hold this in your hand. It's, you know, I feel like as digital creators, I feel like we seldom get the joy of having like physical objects that are our work. So I think that's really exciting.
No, that's makes a lot of sense. And yeah. Books are good. It's a good book. Probably. I haven't read it yet, but I will once it exists.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for listening. This has been really fun talking about the book.
Yeah.
Hopefully as fun as it will be for you all to read it.
Yeah. Hopefully less fun than it will be for you to read it.
Less fun?
If this, yes. Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. I hope reading the book is more fun than sitting and listening to us talk about it. Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.